2019 book, Rule Britannia, written with Sally Tomlinson, Danny argues, in the very near future, the EU referendum will become widely recognised and understood as part of the last vestiges of empire working their way through the British society. So with that provocation, that wonderfully whetting the appetite quote, I'm going to pass you over to Danny. He's going to speak for 45 minutes or so. We'll have 20 minutes of Q&A, and then of course people are free to join us for a small reception at the end of this evening's activities. So Danny, you're very welcome to Liverpool. Very much looking forward to hearing your presentation.
Great. Thank you ever so much for the invitation. It's great to be back in Liverpool. Before I get going, I should say, of course, Brexit is very serious. I've been doing a lot of talks about Brexit, and if I did them with a serious tone all the way through, I would go mad. So I'm not being flippant, but I do think we have to kind of see. Well, the funny side of this, and also I think there's a very, very, very positive side to Brexit, in hindsight, which is only just beginning to be realised. If you want a salutary tale as an academic, looking back at what you got wrong is always interesting. One of the first books I wrote had the title, So You Think You Know About Britain. And I don't recommend you read it unless you want to laugh. Because you can read that book and think, well, he had no idea this was coming. You know, he calls himself an expert human geographer. Why didn't he see Brexit coming? Why didn't he see the biggest crash since 1929? Why didn't he see life expectancy falling? You know, I thought I knew about Britain, but clearly I didn't. Brexit has revealed things certainly I didn't know. There'll probably be somebody in this audience who was sure that they knew all this was going to happen. There may be some of this audience who actually did know all this was going to happen. Whenever I put out this challenge, people often tell me that they emailed their friends and told them it was going to happen. They just didn't put it up in the public domain. I'm going to have to zip through, I've got far too many slides, and I'm determined to get this done in 40 minutes so you can ask questions. This particular slide. Who would have predicted that? 2 months ago? Formation of a new party? Immediately at the top of the polls? This kind of thing doesn't happen in Britain, does it? It's not who we are. That's what foreigners do. They have unstable political systems where that kind of thing can happen. We don't know what's going to happen in 2 weeks' time. We don't know if the young are going to get out of bed and vote. And the most amazing thing occurs. It doesn't really matter how they vote, to be honest. It would actually be quite amazing. They're all worrying about tactical voting, and the key thing is to just get out of bed and vote. All the young have had enough of this. And of course, the old vote, because they always do. And we managed to return even more far-right MEPs to Europe than we already have done, which, in case you hadn't noticed, is by far the largest majority of far-right MEPs in the European Parliament. It's us. We are the far-right state of Europe. I couldn't tell you. I'm obviously biased. You probably already worked out my bias already. I am naturally optimistic, but I'm worried. And I'm hoping it's going to be good. That last graphic appeared in the newspaper. This graphic I've made up. The numbers are real. I've just made it up in the style of the BBC. What the BBC do, there was a time when the BBC didn't do this. What the BBC do when they've got three numbers, or just two numbers, or sometimes just one number, is instead of showing you the number, they create a 3D cylinder and project it down with the number, making it look much more complicated. This is the three parties who lost seats in the local elections that were held recently. The Conservatives lost 1,330 seats, UKIP lost 145, and Labour lost 84. 84 is the same as 1,330. Right, you may not understand this, but if you listen to your BBC commentary, the voters delivered a stinging rebuke to both the main parties. Okay? here's the book, so this isn't all entirely made up. It's sort of post-colonial, except my co-author Sally was around at the time of the colonies. So if you like, this is a blast from two older people about what's going on. The reason for the title of War Britannia, Brexit and the End of Empire is we tried to get behind the reasons, behind the reasons, behind the reasons for why this has happened, and the only thing that we could use to explain why of all the 28 European Union countries, it was us that went first. What was different about us? We had by far the largest empire the world has ever known, larger than all the other European empires put together. We were number one. We have fallen furthest. We still haven't accepted that, recovered from that. And if you do step back and look at world empires, it does take them more than 100 years, often much longer, to get out of their head that they should have control and that they think they can take it back. The book contains things like this. This graphic is showing you the wide variety of political parties to which the super rich donated. You can look around and see what they do. We put it in partly because the book very kindly was published by Lord Ashcroft. Lord Ashcroft owns Bikeback. Lord Ashcroft is in favour of Brexit. Really interesting things have happened. This set of people, and not just this set of people, the banks of the City of London, had assumed that they had paid for, bought and owned a political party, and are discovering that they haven't. It's not theirs. Or a large part of the Conservative Party is not theirs. If you talk to chief executive officers of tier two banks in the City of London, not the top five, the ones just beneath, the largest Japanese bank in the City of London, they'll tell you it's game over. They've moved. Only the CEO, the chief operating officer and the money, the back office, it's now a back office, is still in London. The front office has moved over to Munich or Frankfurt or Amsterdam or Brussels or Dublin, or if you like, the sub Madrid. And it doesn't matter what we do now, because the faith that they have in the stability and safety of the British system, which made it worthwhile to spend an absolute fortune running an office in the most overheated, expensive part of the continent, has gone. And they would not have moved because the cost of moving is so high, but of course they've had to move now. It'll take 12 years for the back office to move entirely, but it's gone. This is not necessarily a bad thing. It is not necessarily a bad thing for banking to be spread out across Europe. In the short term, it is bad for us, but that concentration of bankers may not have made us a happy country over time. There are lots of pictures in the book. This is our brave forces preventing children and their families getting over 3 miles of water to Lesbos. This kind of thing we've been playing at. These are cartoons. This one's from 1901. Daily Express, the pauper foreigner, how the government have been frustrated in their efforts to check alien immigration from Eastern Europe. One thing which is borders on unforgivable is that this is not new for us. There comes a point when you have to learn from your history, and we have not yet reached that point. I think Brexit is a learning experience. One optimistic way of looking at why it's a learning experience is learning is largely done by the young, and the young already seem to be there. But we're certainly teaching them about the views of quite a lot of us who are older, and they don't like it. Another cartoon, again from, I think, 1905. England can no longer offer shelter to fugitives. England is not a free country. Again, the same issue. We introduced an Aliens Act in 1905, the British Union of Fascists was formed. They carried lice, they were terrible, they were taking our jobs, filling up the schools. You know, these were the Jews. We were carving up the world. It was ours to carve up. We were superior to the French. You see, he's smaller. Why were we superior? Well, it was just our fortune that at the time when we discovered, and I know there'll be some people in this room who don't believe this, which is fine, including half of our coalition government, the DUP, and I fully respect that because people have taken me to task on this, but most of us were coming to accept that we were an animal and a species at the time when Charles Darwin produced The Origin of Species, about natural selection and the favoured races of life. Which country was number one in the world at the point that that happened? That way of thinking doesn't go away overnight. William Beveridge, who you remember for producing the report that brought in the welfare state, also wrote that middle class women, only middle class women, should have four children. And the reason they should have four children was for the good of the race, the English race, because the English race was for the good of the world. It's not very long ago. Enoch. I apologise to people who are much younger than me who don't know who Enoch is, but you do need to know about Enoch. There's a kind of pattern. Enoch was Secretary of State for Health when he went out to the Caribbean. I think he went out to the Indian subcontinent and asked people, begged people, to come and work in the health service. Asked people to come and be bus drivers because we didn't have enough people. And they came after we asked them. And then a few years later, he said how terrible it was they came. In 2003, we issued an invitation to the AA countries. Us, Sweden, and a country nobody can ever remember. We opened up our borders early because we wanted people to come to do the jobs we couldn't get people to do or to do jobs better than people were doing. It was an invitation. Germany didn't open up. France didn't open up. We opened up. People came. Not any old people. The most get up and go, fit, entrepreneurial, enthusiastic, best at speaking English people came. And then a few years later, we said how terrible it was they'd come after we chose to invite them. There has to come a point where we just don't do this one again. We have now done this at least three times. Steve Bell, my university, nice chaps, it's always chaps. They're a bit undercover nowadays. We have a Patriot Act now, so that if you do as a set of students form a secret society, you actually can be in trouble with the police. What is it about Britain? Now, why do we have the universities and the education system we have? Why do we have this university? With its endowment and money. Why do we have public schools, boarding schools, and tiers of schools? We have them because we developed them because they were a very, very good thing to create a population who are going to govern the largest empire the world has ever known. You need to take young men away from their families at an early age, and you need to put them into a boarding system, and you need to flag them, and you need to teach them discipline, you need to make them go on long cross-country walks, and you need to tell them that they're superior, and you need to get them to believe in themselves so utterly that when you send them to the Khyber Pass with just 12 men, they will hold it. And that's how you end up controlling a quarter of the world's population. It is very efficient. We were bloody good at it. The problem comes when that empire has dwindled to Gibraltar and you're still producing these kind of attitudes. I'll give you an example. One of the young men in the picture is George Osborne. George Osborne was against the referendum. But in the same year in which the referendum was called, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne promised, said, that if we followed his economic plan, then by the year 2030, Britain would be the richest large country in the world. He actually said that, repeated it, when challenged. Matt Hancock, his lackey, junior minister, had to go out and defend this. Why did George think it was so important that we were, again, the richest country in the world? Within 11 years from now, where does that come from? My friend Sally, what she's an expert in is special educational needs. children who are not that quick, and textbooks. What's been in our textbooks in the 1940s, 50s, 60s and 70s? She's got a copy of the textbook that was used in the school at Boris Johnson, which contains the word watermelon smiles and piccaninnies. Of course he didn't dream these things up, and it isn't entirely his or any of their fault. They didn't choose to be sent to those schools, to be born into those families, to be born in this country with this tradition. Cartoon for the weekend. It's interesting times. Apparently this is Nigel. The question we can never get an answer about Nigel from his school friends in Dulwich School is why he kept on writing his initials so often on the desks and the walls of the school. Anyway, we'll never know. Theresa, in happier times, not very long ago, opening a fete in her constituency. While Home Secretary, and while Home Secretary doing things which in many ways are utterly and completely despicable. Theresa grew up 2 miles to the east of where I grew up. She grew up in the fields of wheat where everybody is white. She grew up in the 1970s, which weren't very nice to grow up, just after the colour bar had been lifted on the Cowley car plant and black men were finally allowed to work on the line. She instigated Operation Bacon. Operation Bacon, the word is taken from Brevik's thesis. Brevik is the man who slaughtered the children on the island. It may be completely coincidental that that word was used. It's basically a far-right word for freedom that fascists use. I think it was a cry for help from somebody in the Home Office who thought somebody will spot this if we actually name it after that. Terrorising people in Britain and deporting people. This is a boy looking at a mocked-up poster. People in London, anarchists in London, now produce these posters and put them on bus stops and they look real. This is a poster warning people not to fill in the school census because the government were going to use the school census to potentially identify children who could be deported. They then eventually promised not to do that. National Front, still alive and kicking. In the 1970s in Oxford, they used to spray on the walls of the subway next to my house about how you had to go back home where you came from. I never thought I would actually grow up to see people actually do this. And the Cabinet. I'm going to try and make it more light-hearted, but some of it's serious. Well, this lot are. We have a whole chapter in the book. The figures chapter, where we go through every member of the cabinet, May's first cabinet, and all their replacements, because there were so many sackings and resignations, and just list the worst things that each of them had done in public, like the most embarrassing. And I challenge you to find any cabinet in the history of British politics that is anything like this. Things are falling apart. This may sound extreme, and I won't go through the examples, but it is quite remarkable. Majority of them are no longer there. Matthew Elliott, chief executive of Herb Leaf, who very kindly sent us this signed photograph and we wrote to him. What? And part of what we do, and I haven't got time on this, trying to work out what was behind the minds of the men who were organising this, and occasionally the woman, behind the men who funded it. How many of them grew up in a colony? How many of them had black servants as children? It's absolutely remarkable. Hence we kept on coming back to the empire again and again and again, and the rightful place of Britain and where we should be. Dominic Cummings was played by Benedict Cumberbatch, quite sympathetically. Alumni of Exeter College, established 1315, Durham School was established 1440. Particular type of people taught a particular kind of thing. If you want to help make my case, Jacob Rees-Mogg has a new book coming out in about 10 days called Great Victorians, which I'm going to get. And it features as one of his 12 Great Victorians, Lord Palmerston. Lord Palmerston is the Prime Minister who sent the gunboats to China to kill them when they tried to stop us importing the opium that we were growing in India, which we're growing in India because we needed the Indians to make some money because they had to buy the textiles that they could no longer make themselves because we wouldn't let them make it, that we were producing just over in Manchester, as you well know, from the cotton which was coming into this port, which was being picked from by the slaves, which we had actually shipped across the Atlantic. We disturbed every continent of the world in a way that they haven't been disturbed before, apart from South America. Parts of South America, which is why Lord Ashcroft lives there, but other than that, apart from South America. So when Michael Gove creates a new geography A-level curriculum, can you guess which part of the world students now study? South America. Predictors of the vote. Hundreds of articles now, but this was produced 3 weeks after the vote. This is the highest correlation. Good eyesight at the very back. Along the y-axis you got percent vote leave, each dot is a local authority district, and on the x-axis you've got adults with a very healthy weight, or percent of adults which are obese. For those of you who don't know the difference, this is overweight. This, after we've eaten tonight, will be obese. I am deliberately keeping myself on the cusp. Partly so that I can talk about this thing without being prejudiced against overweight obese people. The academic who found this, who obviously was very, very excited when he found it, because if you are an early academic like me, when you see something like that, you go, yes, eureka. Published his Tennessee blog 3 weeks after the result and was then torn apart by the Mail, the Sun and the Express. He did make the mistake of suggesting that the reason for the correlation is that people who are fatter are less good at being patient and thinking carefully, whereas you thin people are more prudent and careful, and that's why you're thin. In case you want to know, we have wonderful results from the Human Genome Programme. We now know the reasons why some people are fat and thin. In this particular environment we now live in, for somebody like me to be thin would require a degree of self-control, which would be almost impossible. Those of you who are skinny, it is more your genes than your actual perseverance that does it. So why the correlation? Well, the second highest correlation is with immigration. About 0.79. There's many other reasons. This Public Health England's measure of obesity is actually a bit wrong. But the second highest is with immigration. Those immigrants, the ones we invited in particular from 2003. Young, fit, healthy and thin. Areas with higher rates of immigration into Britain are thinner. And it's not just that the immigrants tend to be thinner and they're younger. But when all these immigrants turn up in your city with their horrible thin bodies, what happens is you eat one less packet of crisps. I can confirm this, because I now live in a city of immigrants, largely English immigrants, but they are all immigrants to Oxford. It's been called the obesity epidemic. Fatness spreads. Once everybody else around you is fat, you're not fat anymore. Okay? And the same with fitness. It's not tardiness amongst certain people. Correlation with deprivation is 0.03. 0.03 is nothing. In some parts of the country, there's a correlation, like London, the poorer parts of London, more likely to vote leave. Almost exactly cancelled out by other parts of the country. Devon's my favourite. Where the more richer parts of Devon vote leave, because that's where the old people live in Devon. Because to be old in Devon requires being able to move into Devon and buy a house in Devon. No correlation. Age above all else. Not qualifications, because qualifications are really about age, largely. Where we have a university degree depends primarily on your age and then whether you've worked hard. Majority of young women in England have a degree. Hardly any women of my grandmother's age have a degree. The young were in bed, 70% of them, or somewhere else, but they weren't voting. They hadn't voted since 1991. But general elections, they didn't vote. They did vote before 1991. Then we brought in a poll tax, which was the best way to stop young people registering and then voting. The older you are, once you get to 45 and above, you're in majority leave territory. But not just majority leave. Much more importantly, look at the turnout. There's nothing else to do when you get to my age. When you get older, there's even less to do. You know, if you go out to the pub at night, you know about it the next morning. One of the most exciting things you can do is go and vote. Turnout is absolutely crucial to this. This is about the far right. I'm running out of time, but basically the far right is whipped up, go down, whipped up, go down. The far graph is another definition of far right. Very simple one. The central conservative grouping in the European Union is called the EPP, the European People's Party. Party our Conservatives used to belong to, it's the party that Merkel is the biggest group in Europe. If you're to the right of the EPP, you are far right. If you are to the right of that, you're extreme right. Our first European election was 1979, no far right. 1984, no far right. 1989 should say 0.1%, because that's what the NF got. By the time you get to 1989, you're on 7.5% referendum party. 2004, UKIP and co, fifth of the vote. 2009, Conservatives have left the EPP. I've given them half the vote, a third. 2014, and none of us spotted this. 2014, European election. 52% of people in Britain who voted for a party to the right of the EPP. And we sent 45-odd far-right MEPs to the Parliament. Sweden sent one. Finland sent one. Germany sent one alternative to Deutschland. Our Conservative Party formed an alliance in 2014 with Alternative for Deutschland, who are neo-Nazis. Now, they broke that in 2016. The far right in Europe would not exist in the Parliament without us. And we go and look over at Europe and go, oh, look at that Austrian president. That looks a bit dodgy. Look at Golden Dawn. They were getting some votes in Greece, but you know they've gone down now. We're it. We're Europeans far right. But you don't notice when it creeps. I didn't notice. Migration across Europe. It's a stretched map so that lovely Scandinavia goes small to stop you getting obsessed with how lovely Scandinavia is. The dark blue areas are high migration areas. The darkest blue means over 1 in 5 people are born abroad. How many people here were born outside of the UK? Give me an idea. Put your hand up if you're born outside the UK. We will not deport you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes, yeah, so we're looking, you're slightly over average for the area. That's typical. The yellow is about 5%. Most of England and Scotland, 5% or less. Most of Eastern Europe, 5% or less. Madrid, high. Costa del Sol, high. Largest migrant group, us. They won't all come back, don't worry. Only the ones that need a hospital will come back. Not the ones with money. Switzerland's high, whole of Northwest Europe is high, there are no borders. You live on the edge of Germany and the Netherlands, you meet somebody, they're very nice, you get together, you stay together, you live in the same house, all of you's a migrant. Or, close to home, Ireland. High immigration. Not the Poles. You're born one side of that known border, which hasn't been a border since the Good Friday Agreement, which we didn't know we had agreed to. And you get together, or just live the other side of that known border. You can't put a yogurt pot on because you'll be breaking an international treaty, let alone upsetting all these people. And you're a migrant. But we're low migration for most of the country. You don't know you're low migration because the newspaper tells you you're high. Yeah. That's why we haven't got full employment, it's just the immigrants. Of course we all have a job if it wasn't for the immigrants. Why aren't the schools great? Must be the immigrants. Why have you got to queue for the hospital? Well, that'll be the immigrants. The immigrants you can't quite see because they're not there, but they're definitely doing it. He chanced it and lost. But he had that confidence that came from the particular kind of background, the particular English Empire background. There's the map. Yellow areas of the main, two kinds of north-south divide. My favourite one, which does this, which there's actually a train that used to do it. From Chepstow and Gloucester up to Cleeforts, when we had a decent train system. Anyway, that one, all that one, okay? Either way, take that one or that one. Look at the amount of blue beneath there. It's 52% of all Leave voters live in the south of England. And it's not because there are more electors there. There's a minority of the electorate in the south of England. But 52% of the voters live in the south of England. It is a southern English vote to leave. I'm going to do this very quickly. That is indisputable. We know to the last single voter exactly who, in terms of location, voted leave, remain, or didn't vote. And its majority is Southern English. It was also a 59% middle class vote to leave, ABC1. And there is some variability around that 59%. Thankfully, Lord Ashcroft did a poll, but it was a large poll. So within 95% probability, it was either 58, 59, or 60% of Leave voters were middle class. Does the middle class vote? Again, because it's turnout. I've created a new national path. I am slightly obsessive, as you now know, to your detriment, you're too polite to begin to leave to wonder, he's mad. But I can't get out of here, obviously. We've got the Pennine Way. We've got Land's End to Willow Grove. This is the Brexit way. We're actually going to do it by cycling, because it's too long to walk. And you wouldn't believe how hard it is to find roads which are safe to cycle, but there are now apps that let you do it. You start off in Cornwall, 56% leave. You go through Devon, 55% leave. Through Dorset, 56. Hampshire, 54. Hampshire's really important. It's big. Isle of Wight, just get some more leavers. Bit of true Britain, 62% almost. Sussex majority, Kent almost 60%, Essex 62%, Suffolk majority, Norfolk majority, Cambridgeshire majority leave, Bedfordshire, Northamptonshire, West Midlands, really big. Worcestershire, you can see we're going through. Finally we get to London, only 40% leave. So a lot. City of London, less than a quarter. Now what I'm going to show you in less than 3 minutes is for each of these areas, I'm going to show you a different set of areas outside the southeast of England which have more voters but fewer Leave voters, just to try to get through. And if you're getting bored, try and think what I'm going to do for the City of London, because that's a really tricky one. How am I going to find somewhere with even fewer Leave voters in the City of London? It's possible. That's your challenge. Start off in Cornwall. We'll compare Cornwall to Nottinghamshire Coalfield. Cornwall produces 183,000 Leave voters, the Coalfield produces 181,000, fewer despite having more voters. I want to get the figures on newspaper reporters. You know, how many newspaper reporters have been up to Nottingham around to talk to people with gruff accents about why they wanted to leave? And how many have been down to Cornwall? And as yet, I don't know any in Cornwall. Devon. And again, you can compare Devon up to North Wales. Gateshead, all added up. More electorate, fewer Leave voters. This isn't a trick. Dorset, compared to North Tyneside, South Tyneside, Northumberland and Torfen, poor part of Wales. Wales was inundated with reporters going, saying, what on earth are you doing? Nobody went down to Dorset, which voted Leave more, and said, what are you doing in Dorset? Very affluent in parts of Dorset. Slightly pudgy. Hampshire. More Leave voters in Hampshire than the combined Leave voters of all of Derby, Great Yarmouth, Merthyr Tydfil, the whole of Sheffield, Blackpool and Leeds. Not a single story about the Leave voters of Hampshire. Isle of Wight, for some reason, I decided to put Luton in the north. Anyway, more league bases in Isle of Wight. Let's assume, so you get the same story, Sussex, Kent, Essex. Essex is enormous. So it's not just those parts of the north. You have to add all of these. I won't read them out. And even then, you've got fewer league voters and more in the electorate. Turnout was higher in the south. Where do the old live? They live in the south. Where do Tory and UKIP voters live? They live in the south. Who voted leave? Where do all the MEPs who are in the European Research Group represent? They represent the south. Let's get round. Suffolk, Norfolk, Cambridgeshire. We can always go back if anybody wants to dispute this, but I think you've probably had enough. Warwickshire, just because it's a bit local. 179,000 Leave voters as compared to just 154 in Sefton and the Wirral. Okay, a bit posh, but bigger electorate. Almost 500,000, well, 450,000 electorate compared to just 419 voters in Warwickshire. Really well organised Leave voting in the south, getting the vote out. West Midlands, more Leave voters in the West Midlands. South and South Ribble, West Lancashire, the whole of Manchester, St Helens, Stockport, whole of Liverpool, Warrington, Holton, Cheshire West, Cheshire East, despite there being fewer. Okay, so let's get round to London. I kind of bore myself a bit silly doing this. London, we have to bang in all of those areas in the north and the whole of Northern Ireland and so on, and still we can't get enough League voters. And yes, a lot of people vote to remain, but that isn't about it. The point is that it's the vast bulk of League voters. Finally, City of London, has anybody got it? Nobody brave? One place outside of the south of England that voted even less League than the City of London is Gibraltar. Sorry, okay. It's a southern, old, middle class, Tory, UKIP vote. There's the regional. Eventually this will get told, because it's the truth. You know, eventually the truth just gets out. Why wasn't this story told? Because there wasn't a story ready, because Remain was supposed to win 52-48. There was no script, it was a shock on the night. The first result came in from Sunderland, and hell, who on those desks in W1A wanted to say that they knew what the answer was, because their parents who lived in Hampshire voted leave. Much easier to say as those stupid Northerners who did it. But at some point it has to go. The British Empire? Because then you've got to ask, well, why did the Southerners vote leave? And of course, it's a bit of a shock if you didn't know it was the Southerners, so we're jumping ahead of it here. And particularly the home counties and the outer home counties. That's our empire as drawn by current population. This is the last colony apart from Gibraltar going in 1997. And these are the kind of stories we tell ourselves. I'm not going to tell you. I've produced a list of famines that you can learn by rote, including all of those in India that we were responsible for, where more than 10 or 11 million people died. And it's a bit more useful to learn than the wives of Henry VIII. But I'm not going to go through the terrible things the empire did if we don't teach ourselves. Just about this young lady crying. If you remember this lady crying, that's my chancellor of my university saying, Danny, stop showing my daughter crying again. Chris Patton is the chancellor of Oxford, the last governor of Hong Kong. All the stories when Hong Kong went were of her crying, the flag going, Royal York Britannia setting off, the sun setting on the British Empire. She wasn't crying about the empire. I don't want to break it to you. She cried for 3 hours. The BBC had cameras on her the whole time. She said why she was crying years later. She was crying because she couldn't understand why mum and dad were not letting her stay with her boyfriend, who was really good at surfing. That's the nicest myth about the British Empire. I go around the country. I've talked in a school in Nuneaton recently. Outside the school gates, you could take a picture like this. We're odd. We don't protest. Well, until 3 weeks ago, 1,000 West. Different countries have different traditions of doing things. The Germans are pretty bad at protesting. Only 30% of their adults have ever been on a protest. But that's twice as good as us. Why? Why are we like we are? we didn't actually have that much to protest about for 200 years because we were making it in. Here's a migration graph for the country, heading up towards 8 or 9 million people coming in. The latest rise is this little million here. That's the European thing. Of course, you get the same graph anywhere else, which is mildly prosperous anywhere else in Europe, just more dramatic, because they're more successful, so they get more migrants. And that's what it looks like if you put everybody else in it. I'm very happy to talk about what it feels like to have your community utterly devastated by migrants. Because I know. Because I went home 6 years ago to the town I grew up in and found that nobody was left because all the bloody migrants had come in and nobody from my school could afford to live there anymore. And everything had changed and it all felt different. What really upsets me is when people go on about 200 Roma in the east of Sheffield and what effect they have on the city of 500,000. A city with one of the lowest out-migration rates that actually has stayed stable, where 3 or 4 generations of family can actually live and carry on, rather than actually talk about what it does feel like to be devastated. Well, if you want to know what it feels like to be devastated by migrants, imagine that you speak your local language and you're really good at it, and other people laugh at your language. And imagine you just want a house, a 3-bed house to start a family, but you can't because the bloody migrants are coming with their money and they're buying it. And imagine if there's no good work for you. And then imagine you're living in the west of Wales and you speak Welsh. The biggest migrant group in Britain are the English retiring to Wales who don't learn the language. Things are obviously dark. These are the 10 to 5 people are sleeping outside the School of Geography in Oxford right now. 6 people died in 2 months on the streets of Oxford early this year, 2 of whom had gone to my school. One was in the year below me, one was in the year below my brother. 4 of the 6 who died were local. And that was a shock, but then we get used to it. That's a pawnbroker in Folkestone being held up. Why did the negotiations go so badly? I realise I'm running out of time, so quickly. Standard and Poor produced this graph before the referendum. It's of what other countries will be most affected by Britain leaving. And the other countries they said were Ireland, although you've got the boom in Dublin. Malta, which is small, Luxembourg is small, Cyprus is small, Switzerland doesn't get the vote because it's not in the EU. Belgium is small, Netherlands is small. Us leaving didn't matter to them. Took us a year to work that one out in the negotiations, so that's why there's 588 pages of rubbish. Over the Germans sell 10% of their cars to us. We've just closed the plant in Swindon. So we're not going to be making our own cars, are we? We're going to be buying more than 10% of the cars from Germany in the future, no matter what we do. Just the smaller ones, which is really good for the environment. So it's not all bad. Tents outside the gates of Trinity College, Cambridge. Trinity College Cambridge is thinking of leaving the country's largest pension scheme, the USS, at the moment, because they like their money. It's a strange country. Swings, or increases in the vote. These are increases in the Labour portion of the vote since 1945. Really weird things started happening after. They were happening before the referendum, but after. So 45 Labour did very well, then it's all a bit lacklustre. Michael Footer is currently in 1983. Tony Blair appears to do well in 1997, but that's after 80 years of conservative rule, which isn't quite as good as a war, but slightly feels like it. We're getting in. Tony loses votes next election. Tony loses even more votes next election. Not good at winning votes apart from 80 years of conservative rule. Paul Gordon Brown loses 6 even more than Tony. But the biggest crash, bigger now than 1929, had occurred. So I let Gordon off. Brilliant, lovely little Henry Land gets 1.4%, which in context is absolutely great. And actually, the history of Labour Party leaders, that is well over average. The only problem is that you need to get 1.4% between 10 and 12 times, which is long after I'm dead, as general elections go, before you actually would win. You see what I mean? And then this man, who can't lead, can't speak, can't do anything, gets 9.6. And this curvy little graph is a measure of the swing. I've drawn 2,000 of these graphs, I can assure you, that until 2 weeks ago, this was the largest, most dramatic swing that had happened in a short amount of time in the history of opinion polling in Britain, until the Brexit Party. Things are changing dramatically, but they change so quickly you don't think they're changing because they change with you. So now when you see a picture of a tower block which had a fire, you think about it in a very different way to how you'd have thought about it 10 years or 20 years ago. And you think about the houses in front of it. These graphs, for any graph addict who wants to know, this is a proportion of public spending as a proportion of GDP. And here's the UK, we were on 37% when Tony Blair was leader. We didn't fix the roof when the sun was shining, that's the increase in public spending. It was very naughty, because if we didn't have the Iraq war, we would have done that. None of it matters compared to the banking crisis. We have to bail the banks out, and that's austerity. And these are a set of absolute basket cases of Venezuelan type countries, where, you know, children are eating dogs in the streets in Finland, France, Denmark, Belgium, Austria. The schools are terrible. The health service, you wouldn't believe it, you know. Can you imagine it, spending 56 or 53 or 51% of your GDP on public services? Where everything would go wrong? Well, we're in Germany on about 45. We're there, but heading to 36. That Jeremy Corbyn, you've got to watch out for him. He wants to make it better to 38. And that's... Well, fuck, that's as fast as politics moves. We are, bar the odd Baltic state, the most economically unequal country in Europe. In 1976, we were the second most equal to Sweden. We've done the experiment. We've shown what happens. We've done an enormous service to the world in Europe. We've demonstrated how important non-borders are. We've demonstrated how important the flow of goods is. We've also demonstrated, if you do mass tests of our 16 to 24-year-olds, that if you have a country like us and an educational system like ours, you're not very good at maths. Same with the USA. Why? Because we're really, really good at getting C's and A's and A stars. Because it's really, really important to get C's and A's and A stars. Because in an unequal country, your grades matter. And so we teach children how to get C's and A's and A stars at GCSE. We don't actually teach them how to do maths. That's what they do in those countries. At least the USA is worse. It's embarrassing. All is not bad. I'm almost at the end. One more slide, you'll be glad to know. The lights are not going out all over Europe. In more countries of Europe, the very small far right they have is falling than the number of countries in Europe in which the far right is rising. The New York Times produce a list of countries every year in the proportions, and they do the best estimates. The European Union is behaving in a much better way than it used to. Greece is behaving in a much better, well, Germany is behaving in a better way to Greece. It's becoming obvious to the EU27 that leaving really isn't an option. The Italians may talk about it, but the repercussions are so unbelievably awful that you wouldn't do it. They're not that interested in us, but they are interested in stories such as the fact that you cannot stockpile enough Prozac because of the sell-by dates to actually supply your population with the antidepressants that it needs to get through the day, which is about 1 in 10 of us now. We don't know what's going to happen at the European elections in 2 weeks' time. I think it matters. I can't predict it. I honestly don't think we can leave, and I'm happy to argue with it. I thought Theresa was going to revoke on the 27th, 28th and 29th of March, and I've been saying that for a year and a half. She just didn't get the emergency that she needed. the only runs on the supermarkets that occurred were on the island of Jersey. There's a bit of stockpiling of toilet paper, you know, because that's the worst thing to run out of. And sanitary products, actually. We can't really afford to leave. It's not quite like whether we should or not. Not really a choice. We might still leave. We might still do a hard Brexit. We already have falling life expectancy. We're the only part of Europe which does. We already have rising infant mortality. We're the only part of Europe which does. We might make a deal. Whatever happens, we're not going to get Empire 2.0. And it's not going to be that easy for the next 10 or 15 years, but we are likely to grow up. The nearest equivalent to this was the Suez Crisis. My mother was 15. That's when she joined the Labour Party. I've yet to join, I'm waiting to get worse. The Suez Crisis was a national embarrassment. It was nothing like this. But within 10 years of the Suez Crisis, you have the 60s. And a change of attitude, change of government, change of policies, radical ideas for England, such as the idea that children could go to the same school as other children on their street. You know, imagine that, we didn't used to have that. That Kathy could actually have some benefits so that she didn't have to wheel her children around in a pram. All those kind of things came in the 60s and early 70s. And they came in partly because of the government who'd arranged Suez was discredited. I think the government who arranged this will be discredited, the political party that arranged this will be split. At some point, people will realise what's actually happened. It's all in the numbers. Who do you think provided the bulk of the £7 million spent on the Remain campaign? The Remain campaign. 4.8 million of the 7 million on remaining was sanctioned by Jeremy Corbyn and collected by the trade union and Labour Party members who spent £4.8 million campaigning to Remain. There's so many things that people just don't know. Aren't remembered. When he said 7 out of 10, he meant 7 out of 10. He's kind of got a Tourette's syndrome of honesty, as that man. It does divide the country, but it's kind of brought the racism out to the head. We thought it had gone away, but it is there. It's going to make people learn, it's going to be uncomfortable. We are going to start to learn about the actual history of our place, not just some token stuff about the old slave museum. There's so much more. You don't get to be the biggest empire the world has ever been without a lot more dirty linen than that. And it has an effect on you, the last few generations. You're constantly looking for a way to get through life without having to work very hard. So you do a big bang in the City of London, and that works for a bit. But there comes a point when you're not special anymore, when you actually can't just get by fooling other people, or being terribly clever and smart and entrepreneurial and inventing vacuum cleaners that you manufacture in Malaysia, or whatever wonderful thing it is we do. And that's where we're getting to with Brexit. My view now is that this was almost a perfect result. In hindsight, if it had been 52% Remain, 48% Leave, that is what the Leavers wanted. Dominic Cummings is very clever. If he thought he was going to win, he wouldn't have done all the things which are now, well, declared illegal by a court, which is why they can't find him. Do you remember the faces of Boris Johnson and Michael Gove on the day of the result? Do you remember how upset they looked? Absolutely wrecked their plans. Boris would have been Prime Minister if he'd been man of the people but not quite got through. 52-48, Remain 52, Leave 48. Hundreds more stories about the terrible immigrants. All of that. And a second referendum we'd have had. And the Leavers would have had a plan. Which, a bit like how we went into Iraq without a plan of how to get out of Iraq, the Brexiteers went into this without a plan of how they're going to get out. Why do they do that? Because they're not stupid. Because they didn't think they were going to win. Because the spread betting told them they weren't going to win. The spread betting had been right on everything else. And the great thing is they won. Because they won, We've learnt things about ourselves that we never knew, and we've strengthened the European Union. And lastly, which country in the whole of Europe now has the largest, most fervent set of European supporters in it? It's the UK. Honestly, you couldn't make out there are more people in the UK who utterly, desperately believe in how important the EU is than in all those countries which have flying the EU flag and have for 30 or 40 years. I'm one of life optimists. I do get angry about racism and fascism. I do think we're living through a time which might well turn out, when people do look back through history, when they say, actually, it wasn't that bad. It was a time when the country finally grew up. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you, Danny. Well, I think we all agree that was a masterclass in the communication and the art of public communication, scholarly ideas, Danny. It was absolutely marvellous. The geo-visualisation, in particular the graphs and the data, there's so complex layers of data that were communicated so effectively, and I think the profound nature of the longer term analysis definitely adds something more than we've heard, which is a lot more kind of local electoral materials. So it's asking bigger questions of Brexit. It's been very instructive this evening, so thank you, Danny. We have 20 minutes question. I promise we will finish in a timely fashion to have time for a reception. But I'd like to open to the floor. Danny's happy to take some questions. I'm sure there's lots in there that people would like to ask. So please, feel free to sit your hand up. And if you could just see who you are and ask your question, that'd be great. Yes.
Simon Capewell, Public Health. Thank you, Danny. A masterly overview. Can I ask you about the political science dimension? It seems to me there's a perfect storm in that we had populist politics, we had mostly right-wing media dominating, the BBC bias is now well recognised. A lot of dark money was moving and being used very effectively. The billionaires were clearly quite keen to avoid the new EU taxes coming in that would have hit their offshore capital. Very happy to accept that the post-empire bereavement kind of set the psychological stage, but what about all those prods, and they were all pushing in the same direction?
Yeah, there's a whole set of things. And also, it has to be said, if I must be fair, you know, there are things you can complain about the EU. And I will admittedly, most of the annoying regulations we instigated, because we love regulations, but yeah, it's a capitalist club, which is partly why Britain was quite happy in it. But that did tip it over a bit. This is going around the world. So the same kind of things that helped get Trump in, when you look at the vote, which was actually falling, the counties with the worst health declines are the ones where the white men most voted for Trump. Brazil, more recently, not France. Do you remember it was supposed to be Trump, Brexit, and then the Front National? And the French showed you how you do it. What you do, if you need to know, suppose there's a man called Nigel and he's doing quite well after the European elections. What you do in France is you all get together and you vote for the very short little bloke you all hate to stop the fascist winning, which is what the French did. And they have the same pressures, which is why there are people in yellow vests out campaigning now. So there's a different way of reacting to the same pressures. But the money is fascinating. If Leave had lost, we would know none of this. We wouldn't know about Cambridge Analytica, which probably didn't matter, because it's the old who voted Leave, and they really are not on Facebook in very, very high numbers for those ages. We wouldn't have known about the 8 million from our banks. We wouldn't have known about the money siphoned through Northern Ireland. We wouldn't have read Jacob Rees-Mogg's dad's last book called Sovereign Wealth, which is a blueprint. This is William Rees-Mogg, the former editor of the Times, for doing this. But on the other hand, without the empire, we wouldn't have this collection of atolls around the world, which have now become the tax havens, which we protect through the Privy Council, which was under threat. That there is a fantasy. You have to remember, Brexit is all about the elite, it's about 1%. Complete opposite about the working class in Middlesbrough. They didn't get together and say, how are we going to get Brexit, as they didn't vote for it either. The plan was one country can set free in the world. One country can have the lowest tax rate, Singapore and the West. One country can collect the highest number of billionaires and the servants. So you get real trickle down. And we can do this. And the alternative is becoming normal. And if you see normal as terrible, and normal means normal schools, not £30,000 a year schools. Normal means social mixing. Normal is an utter betrayal of everything England should be proud of. That's why they fought so hard to get this, because they're fighting for their identity, beliefs, life, family, future, the great Victorians to be remembered properly, the terrible Marxist mad job professors not to be allowed to teach their children. I can see their point of view. You sort of think, why do they bother? And they bother because this is so dear to them to achieve. Why own a newspaper? There are better ways of making money than owning a newspaper. This opens it all up. You begin to ask, why did they own the newspapers? Why did the newspapers run so many stories like this? It's not a conspiracy. It's a core belief of a set of people who believe this is really important. You can read Lord Ashcroft's autobiography, I have done. And he just tells you what he really believes in and why he really believes in it. It's just that left-wing people don't tend to read right-wing people's autobiography. He buys out Victoria medals. He buys any ones he can. He collects because he so much believes in the patriotic military history of the country. He supports Crime Stoppers, wants an authoritarian, well-behaved state, which is getting richer and richer through the behaviour of businessmen like him. It was all there.
Thanks, Simon. I think we're going to be right. Alan's going to ask a question and we'll cross you.
Thanks. Alan Sutton from the University here. And it was really interesting. I like your perspective, which a bit of kind of class analysis in the and the status of the people that you just been mentioned. For example, the Labour Research Departments have done that kind of analysis for a long, long time, showing that politics and the legal system is swayed in a particular way. You also touched on a bit of ethno-nationalism. That's what Will Self has said has been unleashed through the Brexit vote. You kind of make reference to the kind of program of that. We kept using the term we this and we that. Well, of course, here in Liverpool, you might see it as we, that's kind of the concept of we're not English, we are Scouse. Mm. Yeah. But the real, I'll get serious, the real point I want to make is you didn't really uncover the sub-regional and regional identities that can also emerge from something like this. And I know your work is, you've done a lot of regional analysis in your work, and I wondered if you had any views on what might emerge in the likes of Middlesbrough, in the likes of Scotland, in the likes of Yorkshire, on the basis of what's happening in Brexit.
Okay. What else we do? Wales is bang on the UK average. I won't go through the others because it's a short answer. But there's a difference between what's been reported and what you can find evidence for. So Wales voted more like the UK than anywhere else. If you took the English retirees out of Wales, not that they're all the same, I'm glad normally somebody, when I do this talk, somebody over 60 gets very angry and tells me how they voted for Remain. And I do know that people who go to these talks tend to vote Remain. everywhere. Free to Stoke three times. The identities that are emerging as far, they're a whole plethora of what we're getting. Just like in London, there are different kind of Londoners now, and it's different. And like I described, my city hometown of Oxford is now a split city between rich cut incomers and a few locals hanging on by their fingertips to the few remaining council houses that there might be. Different entities are forming in different places. I did work with Michael years ago, where we did the whole lot, very complicated regressions to try to predict what predicted whether a city did well. And I'll never forget, we took it very seriously because I was young, now I do it faster and take the money. But it very seriously, put all these variables in, trying to produce a model of what predicts the success of, you know, Warrington, as opposed to Hastings doing badly. And only one thing came out, and that one thing that came out was, how long does it take the first train in the morning to get to London? And that predicted above all else, he'll tell me there's more to it than that, made a career out of it. So if you look at about an hour from London, like Winchester in the middle of Hampshire, what you'll find, and anywhere now from London, is a triple-decker car park that's been built by the train station now for the commuters from the villages to come in to get into London. And so you've got a uniformity around there that's happened. And then particular stories are told in particular places that's different. So men in gyms in somewhere like Hartlepool will have a subculture that has been investigated and taught, where you will talk about the Illuminati, and it's quite normal to do that. But it's a whole plethora of interesting, fascinating stories that the numbers can only tell you so much. And I'm not very good at going and hanging around in gyms and spotting people, so I read ethnographies as well. But one other thing I'll tell you, I haven't done talks, one thing that does characterise places that voted Leave more often, including those in the south, is really bad train services late at night. Because if you do, so here you voted Remain, but that's because you've got Lime Street and actually a pretty good, not to Manchester, but a pretty good line going the other way. Whereas in most Leave areas, if a talk finishes about 8:30 or 9, there's a good chance you might not get home, even though there's a scheduled train. So they've kind of been left behind. Tewkesbury, chocolate box town. When you actually go, the high street is charity shops, tattoo parlour, Powerland. And the houses are 330,000, 400,000. The younger generation can't afford to buy a home. In an average place without many very good jobs. It's that falling apart feeling that typifies the vast majority of the country, including the majority of the south of England, apart from bits of London, Oxford, Cambridge, a little bit in the middle of Bristol, and often around train stations which were regenerated by New Labour in parts of North that still look a bit flash, but give it another 10 years for the concrete to age and so on, and it won't. But it's your question's really, really hard. The other thing that's really important is people's imagination. So 90% of people will tell you that they voted in a referendum now, and they're not lying. They do believe they voted. We all change our memories. We do it all the time. Particularly the optimistic ones of us. You know, whenever I split up a relationship, it was them, I was reasonable. If you're realistic, you're more likely to become depressed. We know in electoral studies, when you go and vote, you know, they take a ruler and they cross your name out. That's the public document. So we get that. And then when we come and do a survey, knock on your door, we ask you all kinds of things about how you voted. And then we go and check whether you actually did. And we're not checking you for lying. We're checking how do the people who create false memories about their behaviour compare to those who actually did. And this matters for somewhere like here, Liverpool. You can create your entire own new story in a relatively short amount of time about a place. The 1945 government did it. the biggest health improvement that happened in the UK was between 45 and 48, before the NHS even started a single operation. Mortality rates plummeted, and the biggest fall of all was suicides, because the elderly stopped killing themselves because they wouldn't be a burden because something was coming. So, and on the other side, and you saw it in Germany in 1933, and you can see it here, you can suddenly whip up a quite reasonable set of people to behave in a way in which you'll look back in the future and say, how on earth did they do that? And again, it's imagined. We have to do this. They lied to us. They took away our right. It's a bit frightening, but there's an optimistic side to what is possible to do.
Thanks.
We've got
a couple of questions, and then we'll
get into the rest. Yes. I wonder if I'm the only person in the room who voted for Brexit. Does anybody else in the room vote for Brexit?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. I mean, I actually am the founder of the Brexit Party, and I'm also a geographer. And I'm sorry I came in late, because it was a very interesting. I only saw the latter part. I mean, one of the statements you made was, we can't really afford to leave, to leave, yeah?
Yes.
I mean, I could give you an easy answer, we can't afford to stay. I mean, you don't mention target two. There's a deficit between Germany and Spain and France of 1.7 trillion. We have the euro about to implode. We have the European bond market about to implode. We have, we can look at what the left said about what happened in Greece, the Greek finance minister, about the implosion of Greece. The other figure that I disputed, I mean, it was difficult to tell, but my number is that 10 million people are born abroad. On your chart, it looks about 5%, and it certainly didn't look like that percentage. Migration was a massive issue. I mean, it's very interesting that there are so many Remainers, because for the Brexiteers, you are that sort of educated elite that the Brexiteers are complaining about. I mean, one of the things you didn't mention was Jeremy Corbyn was a leaver, as was Tony Benn, and they were leavers all their lives. I mean, I think it's interesting, but I think that I could have presented it. It would really be interesting to have a presentation from a leaver and a Remainer, because I could dispute almost, not even just the chance, but almost every fact. For example, that
okay,
we can't afford to stay.
Get to a question.
Yeah, I mean, I just find it interesting. For example, what target two? Are you aware of target two? Do you know what target two is? Because target two is going to break the European Union in pieces. And it looks like that. I mean, it's 1.7 trillion with the step now. I just would ask people to look at what's going forward.
We give Danny a chance to be responsible.
No, I'm not aware of target two.
Okay, well, I suggest you look at it, because it's going to blow the Europe into smithereens. And right now, for example, the European Union is funding Iran, but I would suggest to you, we can't afford to stay. I would like everybody here to look at, in 2 years' time, at the implosion of the euro, which is...
Sorry, for someone who came in late, I've not seen the presentation. You're not here on the part.
Well, no, but I'm actually asking about topic two.
I think that's the question. You have a fair opportunity to express your views. Thank you for that.
Yeah, your views are very interesting, because you have to be right at the very beginning of the mist. I showed far too many slides. We get there. Now, which is why you have to listen. Because
mm-hmm.
it really is very interesting. And Anastasia, I think she's Anastasia Rees-Mogg, Jacob's sister.
Correct.
I follow her on Twitter. She's standing for the Brexit Party. It's really worth listening. If you are a Remainer, you need to know why.
I founded the Brexit Party, are you aware of that?
Well done.
Yeah, okay. And one of the things, and of course I got completely... Yeah,
I think we're probably out. You've given us a fair opportunity to make
you
special.
But this is not a passing whim. I mean,
thank you for
that. Can we move on to another
question, please? Yes, we'll have another question for that.
Yes, to make an observation, but then I'll move on to a question. So, firstly, I find it quite interesting that often we seem to talk around sort of a colonised mind and sort of an elite who kind of are these passive sort of people in the process and have sort of learned these value systems. And I just wanted to comment on that and say I thought it was quite interesting that it seemed like less like, you know, that there was an active role in that it was something passive that they learned and how much we should hold them accountable for that.
Oh yes, it's very passive. This is what my co-author Sally specialises in. So she looks at textbooks and what people are taught at different ages. What you're taught at school, what you're taught at university, and how you come to believe certain things. And it's very, very passive. So there's a whole set of things that are in me, some of which I recognise, some of which I don't. I actually get quite emotionally involved with this in a way I wouldn't have thought I would. Because I now know I am absolutely, definitely English, in a way I didn't know 3 or 4 years ago. Partly because I have no other bloody passport and no chance of getting one, so I'm stuck here. But it's that kind of thing. It's like, Sally looked at the school books that were taught, that were used in the schools of the politicians. Fetters, where Blair went, is a military school, which if you know that, it helps understand that. She looked at Boris Johnson's textbook from his prep school, which used the word, I said, kick in their knees and watermelon smiles in the book. So it's subtle.
I just think it's how much we then hold people to account for things that can perpetuate quite harmful. But then my actual question is probably more, considering a lot of your work has always been around inequality, and then obviously moving on to this, how much you feel that Brexit may perpetuate inequalities.
Oh, well, no, I think you could bring it to a head and end it. Well, not end it, but be the thing. Inequality last peaked 1913. The war, which was supposed to last a few weeks, went on for 4 years. You could only fund that war by taxing the rich, so there was no money. That was the beginning of going down. Then, 1945 was the other big drop down in inequality. Because when you came back, having had to fight a second war, which De Lee could have avoided, you never trusted the old again, and we brought in something new. Inequality then began to creep up, and it crept up partly because conservative parties around Europe want more inequality, just rewarding the talented and not. But it rose up faster in the UK than anywhere else, because there was a legacy demand from those who have had money, who'd lost the most in the world, to get back to their rightful place. Inequality is now teetering by various measures. You're getting the men at the very tops made redundant. I'm always wary about how you say this. Martin Sorrell, after he was seen entering a place in Mayfair, he says he didn't enter. Went, the richest, highest paid man in Britain, not richest, highest income. The boss of the building firm, after what he thought was off camera, he made a threat to a BBC journalist, went. Top CEO salaries at the top are going down. Not the median. The median CO2 is quietly taking a bit more, but the top's going down. Bankers who were getting 10 million a year are now getting 5. And that's the very top. The problem is there's more destitution at the bottom. Now, Brexit, unless it results in enormous economic success and the spreading of that wealth around, because the poor can't lose any more because they are the poorest in Europe, if Brexit results in the middle class and the wealthy not doing well, or call it the Brexit betrayal of the main classes not carrying out the true Brexit that would create this wonderful future, if that happens, inequalities have to fall. And just like the last time they fall because everybody goes down a bit. And it doesn't feel good. The 1920s and 1930s didn't feel good, but they were the fastest fall. The 1940s we had rationing and austerity in the 50s, but it was coming down. A fall in inequality, unfortunately, is 20 years of pain, unless you learn from history and actually realise what you're heading towards, and begin to arrange things so that life is more pleasant with less money. Which simply requires things like not segregating our children in separate schools. Not saying that a hierarchy of universities is such a wonderful thing because it gets the golden shards to come to Oxford where they can be turned into future prime ministers. You know, there are loads of easy things that we can do which cost nothing that make life better. What costs ultimately is health. If we wanted a German health system, we'd need an extra 1 billion euros a week. Billion a week. And you only get 350 million, or you don't. And getting rid of a nuclear deterrent doesn't actually save you that much. Bid. Not having an aircraft carrier would help, if you're looking at what does Germany do. But actually, normal European levels of taxation. And we are miles away from that. But if there is an emergency economically in the next few years because of what's happening, in economic emergencies, the same as at a time of war, you introduce new taxes. Within a year or two of introducing a new tax, people don't complain about it, they're completely used to it. So it could be much, much better. Coupled to that, the fact that if we don't become more equal, the planet's going to burn to death. You know, the pessimistic thing is the planet burning to death. The optimistic thing is the arguments. The people who are arguing for the alternative are really arguing for Armageddon, and it isn't very hard to argue against Armageddon, particularly when you've got the young on your side. A 1,000 people getting arrested 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. You know, maybe fairly posh people, but many, many times more than got arrested in 1968 in the LSE. We've never done this before. The government are talking about building a motorway between Oxford and Cambridge as the outer ring road of the M25, because London will look like Beijing in future with a series of roads, because Brexit's going to be so successful that we need to build this. Now, and they're trying to go ahead with this, bulldoze and so on. Just imagine how many young road protesters we're going to get if they do start trying to build a six-lane motorway through Tory seats from London to Cambridge for the future economic boom that they're about to create. It's an amazing time to be living in. We mustn't take the mickey of people who believe in it.
Danny, thank you so much. We could go on and on, and obviously there's lots of energy and discussion in the room, but I'm going to call it a halt because we will have a chance to chat further over the reception. I think that was a wonderful presentation. So I believe it's so important, given the socio-demographic composition of the Oxford graduating classes that Danny spoke about, that we have a half of Mackinder, Professor of Geography, who's espousing and articulating the kind of important analyses and views that Danny is. So we're so privileged and delighted, Danny, to have you here. In the light of the observation of the correlation between obesity and the important, Danny and I will be going for a Caesar salad water shortly, but please do join us for a brief reception, and feel free to come and join us in the next 20 minutes or so. Thank you very much.